Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The world's diplomatic community is trying to parse the latest comments from Condoleezza Rice. On the last leg of her European tour, the Secretary of State has gone to unusual lengths to try to clarify the U.S. position on the torture and abuse of U.S. terror suspects abroad. Today, at a NATO press conference, Rice said she can't guarantee that detainees won't be abused again.
Will there be abuses of policy? That is entirely possible, because just because you are a democracy, it doesn't mean that you're perfect.
But at a dinner with European foreign ministers last night, Condoleezza Rice initiated and led a long discussion of torture and the alleged secret CIA prisons that have roiled Europe for a month now. And she reportedly won over many by saying that no U.S. personnel are allowed to commit abuses, whether on U.S. soil or overseas. Now, some seized on that last part of the comment as new U.S. policy, which the White House immediately denied. Well, joining us on the line from Washington, D.C. is Josh White, Pentagon reporter for The Washington Post. And Josh, more questions than answers, it seems. What exactly did Secretary Rice say about U.S. policy on torture, and is it a significant policy change?
Well, Robin, what Secretary Rice said was that the United States, that all U.S. personnel, wherever they are, whether they're in the United States or outside of the United States, must abide by the obligations under the U.N. Convention Against Torture, which prohibits cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment. By saying that it's the U.S. policy that this won't happen, it's really the first time that Secretary Rice or anyone else from the administration has come out and publicly said that all U.S. personnel, all U.S. officials around the world must abide by these obligations.
Well, the White House spokesperson Scott McClellan is also saying this is not new policy. You write he appears to be referring to the fact that Attorney General Gonzalez confirmed this policy during congressional testimony last October.
Right, and those statements were made privately to members of the Senate Judiciary Committee and were not really stated publicly. And the Bush administration very specifically has said a number of times that these rules, these obligations, do not apply on foreign soil, which would allow, for example, different treatment at Guantanamo Bay or at facilities in Europe or the Middle East.
Well, and that's what many Americans may be thinking, that while the White House is now saying this is policy, Vice President Dick Cheney has been pushing for an exemption to John McCain's proposed law banning torture.
Well, the Vice President and others in the administration have backed off of that very aggressive stance in part because they see that Senator McCain, who, obviously a former POW in the Vietnam War, lots of credibility, really unimpeachable on this issue, has gained a lot of momentum on the Hill, and that fighting it at this point was really not getting them anywhere. Senator McCain has stuck to his position, has encouraged many others to stick by it as well. That language, very specifically a ban on cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment, would prevent certain tactics that the military has used, that the CIA has used in its fight in the war on terror. And the White House had been fighting to establish some exception that would allow some deviation from that terminology. Now, a White House policy, as Secretary Rice explained, is just policy. The administration could deviate from that at any point. Once it becomes law, once it becomes part of the U.S. regulations, it would be very hard to justify deviating from that policy.
Well, if you can talk for a second about what Secretary Rice did not say. She didn't give examples of abusive tactics. She didn't define torture. And she didn't say if the no abuse and no torture policy applies to CIA contractors or foreign operatives who may be interrogating U.S. terror suspects abroad.
Correct. There are certainly a lot of openings here for interpretation, and certainly, again, because it is U.S. policy, something that could and probably has changed over time.
Briefly, Josh, is the White House united on this policy, or is there dissent, as we saw, between the Powell State Department and the White House?
My understanding is that there's been a lot of discussion on this, that there are a number of different opinions floating around, and that people have been very passionate from a number of different angles on this issue. For example, the Defense Department has some language that they're working on that in a lot of ways mirrors Senator McCain's language, and that's something that the White House was fighting aggressively. My understanding is that aggressive fight has toned down a bit, and that there is on a number of levels acceptance that this legislative push has really changed the way that they look at the issue, and Secretary Rice's public comments may be a hint of that.
Josh White, Pentagon correspondent for The Washington Post. Josh, thanks so much.
You're welcome, Robin.
Did you know that 43 states in this country offer pre-kindergarten? That about half of all 3- and 4-year-olds in the U.S. go to preschool, sometimes in public schools? We want to spend a few minutes today on the movement toward universal preschool education, one of the strongest movements in education today. 41 states already provide some type of preschool, and just this week, the National Institute for Early Education Research at Rutgers University released a study evaluating pre-K programs in 5 states. Their results were promising. Children in public school programs outperformed students in the federally funded Head Start. But there were some problems as well, and we're going to discuss this issue with 2 national experts in a moment. First, a visit to the Lee Academy Pilot School in Dorchester, Massachusetts, here in Boston. It's an innovative school that serves kids from ages 3 to 11. Our guide is Principal Kyle Dodson.
Cupcakes? Water-flavored cupcakes? Jamara, are you helping? What's Jamara doing?
We're currently in a combined 3- and 4-year-old classroom, and the children are learning a number of things. One of the biggest things, they're learning how to play appropriately.
I found something when I was cleaning up the classroom yesterday that I wanted to get a chance to show you. Take a look at Bear. Do you notice anything on his fur?
Yeah.
What do you notice?
We got marker on him.
Whatever happened, we need to make sure that Mr. Bear's fur does not get drawn on anymore. He was so sad when I got to school this morning. Do you know what he was doing?
Oh no, my fur is purple.
He was crying, Ronnie. He was so sad. Poor Bear.
What we're doing here is I would suggest that a 3-year-old being in school or a 4-year-old being in school is like many other places along the educational spectrum. It's an attractive option. It's not the only option. We're not saying that 3-year-old school is important to replace those 3-year-olds being with mom at home or being in a different setting, but we are interested in bringing into the conversation what we know about child development, what things it's important for children to have access to. And here in Dorchester, a predominantly low-income minority community, if those things we're talking about being healthy for children aren't available to children elsewhere, then we really need to have these sorts of environments where they can get those sorts of opportunities.
That's the Lee Academy Pilot School in Dorchester, Massachusetts. Some of the sounds from the school and the sounds from perhaps the future of all schools. Joining us now to talk about this move to send 3-year-olds to school, we have Kathleen McCartney, acting dean at the Harvard Graduate School of Education and an expert in early childhood development. Welcome, Kathleen.
Thank you.
We're also joined on the line by Dick Clifford, a senior scientist at the FPG Child Development Institute at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He's joining us from a studio in Washington, D.C., where he's on business. Dick, welcome to you as well.
Thank you, Robin.
And Kathleen, here in Boston, you and I both participated in a program here in the city called Principal for a Day, where we got to be principals at schools. I want to talk about that in a second, but I went to one of the early, the Mattapan, in fact, early learning, early education center, which is for 3- and 4- and 5-year-olds. I went in very skeptical, thinking 3-year-olds in school. Now, first of all, a lot of people think that, so and are thinking that right now, hearing this for the first time. What's your response to that, you know, skepticism and fear about sending 3-year-olds to school?
Well, one reaction is that it's distinctly American. In other parts of the world, early education is more a part of the culture and valued, and people don't worry about it as much.
And so they do go to school earlier in other countries?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, in most of Western Europe, they would refer to it as early education, and it is as valued as K-12 education.
Well, and I went to the Mattapan Early Education Center, real principal, by the way, Nora Tony, and it was magnificent. Here were these little 3-year-olds in their classrooms, completely structured days. It seemed to be having a wonderful effect on them. Dick Clifford, is this something that educators are thinking can benefit all kids, all 3- and 4-year-olds?
Yes, definitely. I think probably the greatest value is for children who are seen as at risk of not doing well once they get to the kindergarten, But I think generally people say this is good for all children.
Well, and let's take a look at some of the comparisons. Now, I mentioned that there was a study, a Head Start study that you made a comparison to. Kathleen, the Rutgers study, said that the in five states that were studied, the public pre-K programs outperformed the Head Start study. A lot of people are probably wondering, what's the difference? What is the difference?
Well, early education goes by many names, pre-kindergarten, nursery school, child care, Head Start, and so on. Usually when you hear the term pre-K, it's associated with some state-sponsored initiative. But if you went into classrooms, I don't think you could distinguish whether or not it was a Head Start center or a pre-K center or a nursery center. I mean, they tend to look the same with respect to curriculum. What varies is the quality of the programming. But when children are in high-quality early education programs, they thrive both cognitively and socially.
But isn't there a difference, Kathleen, between, let's say, a Head Start and a three-year-old who goes to class in a school that has older kids in class as well? I mean, there's something that there does feel like there's a distinction there. That feels more like school.
Well, I think the point I'm trying to make is that early education is delivered across many settings. I mean, sometimes it's in child care centers, sometimes it's in public schools, sometimes it's in private schools, sometimes it's in home-based settings. And even in some state-sponsored initiatives, they will partner with people who provide early education across a wide diversity of settings.
And Dick Clifford, if you could jump in on that as well, because that's what felt different to me about going to a school which had several grades, several ages. We heard from the Lee Academy. It just feels more like school than, you know, preschool has in the past to many of us. Is that a distinction that needs to be paid attention to?
I think so. I just echo Kathleen's comments that in the U.S. in our studies, we found that roughly half of all of the pre-kindergarten programs in state-funded pre-kindergarten efforts are in the private sector and about half in public schools. So we do see a broad range there. Interestingly, we don't see much difference between those that are in private sector and public. So maybe from that point of view, it's not such a big deal that we're seeing kids in public schools. And yet, we do see some tendency for programs in public schools to have to face obstacles. The playgrounds, for instance, generally are designed for older children rather than for 3- and 4-year-old children, and in fact may be dangerous for the younger children.
And in fact, some parents may be wondering about sending their 3-year-old into a school with an 11-year-old. They may not want that kind of influence at that point. We'll talk about more of the problems in a moment, but we heard at the Lee Academy, many of the students who are participating in these 3- and 4-year-old classrooms are from low-income families. And your study, Dick, showed that pre-K programs are being offered exclusively to at-risk kids?
Well, not exclusively, but certainly that's the priority in most states. There are a few states, New York, Georgia, Oklahoma, a few states that are working toward universal access. But most states have at least started with at-risk children. And even in those, New York, for instance, they give priority to districts with a lot of low-income children.
That's Dick Clifford, a senior scientist at the FPG Child Development Institute at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. We're also speaking with Kathleen McCartney, acting dean at the Harvard Graduate School of Education and expert in early childhood development. We're talking about sending 3- and 4-year-olds to school. Here in Boston, they are saying in 10 years, every 3-year-old will be in school. What are some of the problems that have to be gotten past before that can happen? And will it be required for every little rugrat? Stay with us. Many more questions and some answers ahead. This is Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and today we're taking a look at publicly funded preschool programs. This year, states have increased funding to pre-K programs by $600 million. It seems extraordinary in a time of budget cuts, but it's a sign of how much support these programs have nationwide. We've been speaking with Kathleen McCartney, acting dean at the Harvard Grad School of Education and expert in early childhood development, and Dick Clifford, a senior scientist at the FPG Child Development Institute at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He's been speaking to us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. And Kathleen, just looking at that number, that's one of the questions I have. How does this get paid for when we can't pay for programs for seniors? How do you put 3- and 4-year-olds in the classroom?
Well, I think you're right that funding is a major barrier. In Massachusetts, where we just
passed the Early Education for All bill, I would attribute the success of that to the fact that community leaders from business and labor, even religion, you know, partnered together with philanthropists and early childhood experts. And what they argued, based on the research, is that if you invest early, you actually end up saving money later on. So every $1 you invest in early education ends up saving you $7 down the road, because children are less likely to need special education services, for example.
Yeah. And people and parents are clamoring for it here in, again, the Boston area. Dick Clifford, I don't know if you've had this experience elsewhere as well, but the mayor, Mayor Menino, was telling me that his daughter was begging him, please, Dad, can you help me get my kids into the Mattapan Early Education Center? It's so great. And he said, no, it's a lottery right now. It's kids from the neighborhood, and it turns out to be many at-risk kids. But, you know, the hope is that these parents out in the suburbs may even want to move back into the city to go to some of these early education classes. But you have done a study and seen that while it's promising, there are some problems. What are the problems that you see?
Let me respond to your first comment for a second. I do think we're moving toward universal access for all four-year-olds in the relatively near future, and for three-year-olds eventually. It's part of the shift in society. It reflects the changes in the way we rear children, the women increasingly in the workforce, and mm-hmm. the need for families for support. And this is one of those. But as we've moved toward increasing access to pre-K programs, expanded them, what I would call going to scale, states and localities have experienced difficulties in that. And while we found that programs generally met accepted standards for child-staff ratio or class size and for teacher training, they're still struggling at the implementation level of getting these programs to do the things that we know are good for children in these settings. So our measures of the quality, what we call process quality in the classroom itself, are not that great. They're okay, but they certainly need to be improved if we want to take advantage of what preschool can offer for all children.
Yardsticks like making sure that kids are actually doing something, that they have contact with the teacher, that they're actually learning.
Yes, we found that children spent a lot of time not engaged in anything. About 45% of the time they were not engaged in anything that we considered to be a learning activity. And that seems that's much too much of unengaged activity.
Well, and there are some parents I know who are listening, Kathleen, who are saying, I don't want to have my three-year-old have a structured day. That's exactly what I would want. Do you foresee a future where this would be required, that three-year-olds go to school?
I don't see that happening in the near future. I mean, right now states are talking about it being an option. But I think if parents were educated about what early education could offer, most of them would be enthusiastic. I mean, in the better quality programs, there's a balance between play and instruction. I mean, you don't see children engaged in worksheets the way you do in second grade when you go into a good four-year-old classroom.
Although, I was at the Mattapan Early Education Center here in Boston, and it was amazing how much they loved the structured environment that they had. And they didn't know it, but they were moving between classes. Dick, your group wants to establish something called First School. This might address some of the other concerns parents have, that they don't want three-year-olds in a school where they're going to have peer pressure from 11-year-olds.
Right. I think we're seeing a move in America in public schools that have included 3- and 4-year-olds in sort of a haphazard way. And our goal is to try to help make this a more thoughtful and planned way that we involve 3- and 4-year-olds in school settings.
It would be 3- to 8-year-olds?
Yeah, we're talking about a pre-kindergarten through third grade sort of arrangement. And I do think there's a big move toward in that direction in the U.S.
And so there would be maybe a first school, a middle school, and a high school. What would you teach a three-year-old?
Well, three-year-olds start learning language, certainly using a lot of oral language, and so a lot of verbal interactions between adults and children and among children is critical during this period of time. So they're beginning math. There are lots of all of the major things we teach children, they are actually beginning to learn at this period in their lives.
That's Dick Clifford, senior scientist at the FPG Child Development Institute at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. They're studying this and suggesting this new first school for 3- to 8-year-olds. But Kathleen, in the schools that I have seen so far, the one thought I had is that they seem awfully homogenous. They do tend to be right now for at-risk kids. the thought being that that would help bridge the achievement gap once they get into the other grades. Is there a concern that if it doesn't shift, if it doesn't become more than at-risk kids, it's too homogenous a setting for little ones?
Yeah, that's the issue with Head Start, really, which was designed for at-risk kids. But if you look at the pre-K movement across the country, that's not what you see. I mean, Georgia was the first state to offer publicly funded universal pre-K, and it's for all four-year-olds, not just for at-risk children. I think we can expect that in Massachusetts as well.
Yeah. And, Dick, one last question. Of course, teachers are at the core of every education initiative. We have about a minute left. Do we have to train and find a new breed of teachers for three-year-olds?
I think we do, and we are in the process of doing that. But we definitely need people who are trained well and serving young children and aren't taking the traditional elementary school model and moving it down to three-year-olds.
Well, again, I know you've provoked a lot of thought at homes right now where little three-year-olds are hanging off the pant leg of their mom. The new thought of sending three-year-olds to school. Dick Clifford, senior scientist at the FPG Child Development Institute at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill, speaking to us from the NPR studios in Washington. Dick, thanks.
Thank you.
And Kathleen McCartney, acting dean at the Harvard Grad School of Education and expert in early childhood development. Kathleen, thanks for your input as well.
It's been a pleasure.
And it's a story we're going to continue to follow. The Rugrats go to school. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Regional federal emergency managers are testifying on Capitol Hill today about the response to Hurricane Katrina. They're expected to tell a Senate committee that more than a year before Katrina, they warned their bosses in Washington that they were not prepared to handle a major disaster. Well, Hurricane Katrina was also discussed at the UN Conference on Climate Change taking place in Montreal. Representatives from hurricane-ravaged states traveled there to urge the Bush administration to address global warming. Stephen Smith is the executive director of the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy, one of the groups that helped organize the U.S. delegation to Montreal. And, Stephen, we talked with a reporter in Montreal yesterday who said your delegation is saying the same things about global warming that developing nations were saying 5 years ago. Were you aware of that?
Well, I wasn't aware of the relationship with the developing countries, but we were very passionate in Montreal about the impacts to our country and the fact that we need to take action.
Well, do you really believe that global warming was behind, for instance, Katrina?
Well, it's very difficult to attribute it to any single hurricane, but the scientific evidence is very strong that the intensity of hurricanes is now related to global warming. And the science is still out on the frequency, but our point was that we need to be conservative and we need to protect the coastal communities, and there is an appearing relationship here.
And now who did you organize to go on the trip? And what's the main message that you want to bring there?
Well, we had a number of representatives. We had Bill Stallworth, who's a city council member from Biloxi. We had Jerome Ringo, who is from Lake Charles, Louisiana. And we had Carolyn McCormick, who's with the Outer Banks Visitors Bureau there in Nag's Head on the Outer Banks of North Carolina. And our message was that while most people think the southern United States is conservative and we don't have political leadership on this issue, the people of the Southeast are beginning to see the connection, and we are feeling the effects, and we need leadership from our elected representatives and from our federal government, and we're not getting it in Montreal.
Do you think that by going to the conference, in addition to airing your concerns with experts there and perhaps getting some feedback, are you making a statement to the Bush administration?
Very definitely. The Bush administration is not providing leadership. They're actually being incalcitrant on the issue, not hooking up with the international community and moving forward. So our message was clearly to the delegation that was there from the U.S. that they're not representing the U.S. well in their current position. But our message was also to the rest of the world that the United States is engaging on this issue, that we are concerned about it. The local and state governments are doing anything. Where we're getting failure of leadership is at the federal level through this administration.
Well, as you know, a State Department rep in Montreal yesterday defended the Bush administration, said Washington believes it can do more to reduce greenhouse gases without international treaties. Washington has repeated it will spend a significant amount of money on this over the next few years. Why is an international treaty necessary? I mean, some would even say that emissions have gone down through other methods.
Well, we applaud any effort because this problem is so serious. And yes, it's a good thing that the Bush administration is engaging with other countries in limited ways. The reality is the problem is so serious, the reductions that are needed are so substantial, there is no way that voluntary measures are going to get us there. We need very clearly defined rules of the road so we can develop a carbon marketplace that is developing in other countries. The United States needs to engage in that. The companies that produce these emissions and upstart companies that are going to be a solution to these issues need to be able to know these rules of the road, and they need to be solidified through international treaty, and our government needs to be at the table playing a constructive role, not trying to strip this up.
Well, how have other countries received you there?
We've been tremendously well received, particularly by the Canadians, because they very much wanted this international negotiation, the first to have happened in North America, to have a strong presence from the United States other than just the Bush administration. And so we were very warmly welcomed, and our message was well received. Other countries are hungry for any sign that the United States is going to play a constructive role in the international community on this issue, particularly those countries that are feeling the effects in real time, and many of the developing countries, because they know that their issues of development are only going to be made worse by the destabilization of our climate.
Well, I was going to say, American Eskimos filed a complaint yesterday against the U.S. with the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, saying that U.S. emissions are threatening Eskimo traditions. We spoke yesterday of people having to be moved off of islands off of Papua New Guinea because of the effects of global warming. But you know, there are people here in the U.S. even after watching the horrendous hurricanes this past season, while being incredibly supportive of people on the coast, many Americans have also said, you know what, this may be a fact of life. What do you say to Americans who say, well, that's a coastal problem and it doesn't affect me?
Having lost our place to Ivan last year, the devastating hurricane that went through the panhandle of Florida, there are legitimate issues that we need to be addressing about coastal development. And I think those are very legitimate questions to ask. But we do not need to use the issues around coastal development as some way to deflect the real issue here, which is the destabilization of the climate. A 35-foot storm surge, which we saw in Katrina, 25-foot storm surge, which we saw in Ivan last year, these are unprecedented events. And so these are reaching well inland. These hurricanes, they don't stop at the coast. They move inland, cause flooding throughout the southeast United States, areas like the Outer Banks, the Florida Everglades, the wetlands of Louisiana, all these areas. So whether you're developed there or not, these are natural treasures that we need to protect.
Stephen Smith, again, Executive Director of the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy, a group that took several people, including officials from different Gulf Coast cities, to the UN Conference on Climate Change in Montreal. Now these people go back to their ravaged towns where they have more practical concerns about building houses and jumpstarting the economy. With those practical concerns, do you think that these people are going to continue to work on something as, you know, intangible as global warming?
Well, for the people that are in Mississippi and Louisiana, global warming is very tangible. I mean, they have seen the impacts of climate destabilization.
But, I mean, the feeling that you can't do anything about it.
Well, I hope that's not the case, because when they rebuild the homes in New Orleans, do they rebuild them to higher standards, not only to protect them strength-wise, but also more energy efficient? Do we look to how we use transportation and what kind of fuels? In the southeast, we have a tremendous agriculture sector that could be providing biofuels as opposed to fossil fuels. And these types of things would lead us to working on solutions at the same time we work on the economy. So it's really having leadership to connect those links between protecting us from the threats, but also seizing the opportunities, because global warming is a very dangerous thing, but it also creates an opportunity for new technologies to be deployed. And so I hope that the leaders that spoke at the conference in Montreal with us, and we plan to continue to work with them, we'll look for ways that the local communities can hook up with the states, can hook up with the federal government, ultimately to look at solutions and opportunities as well as protecting against the threat.
Stephen, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Stephen Smith, Executive Director of the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. You're listening to Here and Now. Fans are gathering in Liverpool, Paris, and Japan. They're placing candles and flowers outside the Dakota apartment building in New York, where musician John Lennon was murdered 25 years ago today. The events come rushing back. Lennon, buoyant with a new album, poised for a comeback, shot by a deranged fan at close range and stumbling to the ground on a chilly winter night. The killer kicks away his gun and thumbs through The Catcher in the Rye. Howard Cosell announces the news to the nation on Monday Night Football. Here are some of the sounds from outside the Dakota on that night in 1980.
Howard Cosell told me John Lennon was dead, kind of stunned. I never met the man, but I grew up with his music in him, and I feel like he's a brother.
I don't know why I'm here, and I don't know why he was shot, and I don't know why most of the things happen the way they do. I just was upset, and I wanted to be here.
John Stevens is associate professor of songwriting at Berklee School of Music here in Boston. He's been teaching popular classes on John Lennon since John's death. And John Stevens, John Lennon would have been 65 years old this year. Does this music really resonate with students who wouldn't even have been alive when John died?
They're set aside as classics, really. So studying the music of the Beatles is kind of like studying music of Mozart and Beethoven in a way. It's sort of so many things like R.E.M. and Nirvana and other groups just emanate from the Beatles.
Tell us some of the things you teach.
Well, like this, the song from Rubber Soul called In My Life, listed as Lennon-McCartney. But it's basically Lennon. McCartney did actually help with a couple of chords in the second half of the song. The phrasing is set up with two little ideas. Dee-da-dee-da-da-da, followed by da-da-da-da, ba-ba-da. And those two rhythms just appear throughout the entire song.
There are places I remember all my life, though some have changed, some forever, not more.
So we notice that in the first half he does that off of A major, and the second half kind of based off of this other chord, F sharp minor, leading into the very beautiful setting at the bottom, 4 minor to 1, which is makes it real dark and poignant. In my life, I've loved them all, or I've loved you more, and so on.
In my life, I've loved them all.
And so we see this rhythmic, this is the key to really songwriting, picking a good little rhythm for your melody that people can remember. And and then keeping it going with changing chords and changing lyrics until it reaches a peak of the title. And Lennon was just, of course, fantastic at doing that.
What about post-Beatles? I'm looking at Double Fantasy, and songs like, well, Beautiful Boy jumps out at me.
Yeah, well, that's sort of my favorite song on the album. Because he has that line in it, life is what happens to you when you're busy making other plans. And that line is set up so well because the previous verses in that just talk about go to sleep, you know, daddy's here, and let me hold your hand while you cross the street. Just really sort of mundane things between a father and son. Then he comes out with this big, giant statement right at the end, which would be great advice for someone young or old.
Life is what happens to you while you're busy making other plans. Beautiful, 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 beautiful boy.
John Stevens, associate professor of songwriting at Berklee School of Music. He's been teaching classes on John Lennon for the past 25 years. He's also a lead vocalist and guitarist for the all-Beatles music group, the Blue Meanies. And by the way, is this a sad day for you, or a, sort of a...
It's a little sad, more poignant, I guess, because I do get to celebrate his music and listen to it. I notice, of course, that a lot of others do the same, so that makes me feel good.
Beautiful, 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 beautiful boy.
Again, John Stevens. For 25 years, he's taught a course on the music of John Lennon at Berklee School of Music here in Boston. John Lennon was killed 25 years ago today. Stay with us. More ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. When the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941, the U.S., of course, entered the horrific World War II. But a nightmare also began for thousands of Japanese Americans living on the West Coast. Within 48 hours, the FBI arrested some 3,000 Japanese men living in the U.S., and with a few months, some 120,000 Japanese Americans, two-thirds of whom were American citizens, were made to leave their homes and move into internment camps. But though they were forced to give up most of their possessions, as writer Delphine Hiratsuna discovered, many of the interned were able to add some beauty to their lives. Delphine has published a collection of images of the art created in the camps in a new book called The Art of Gaman, Arts and Crafts from the Japanese-American Internment Camps, 1942 to 1946. And Delphine joins us on the line from KQED in San Francisco. Welcome.
Hello, Robin.
What a beautiful book. These objects are beautiful, but before we talk about them, how did you even think to look for them?
I hadn't thought about it. I sort of lived with some of the objects all my life, but until my mother died in 2000, I really hadn't thought about it. And I was cleaning out one of her jewelry boxes, and I came across a wooden pin that had a safety pin back, and it was hand-painted, and I sort of figured out that it must have been made in the camps. That got me to thinking about what else might be out there and what might be in people's homes. And since people are getting older, it seemed like it was now or never that we capture this time in history.
And since, as your family story points out, you being a third-generation Japanese-American whose family was interned, people didn't talk about it. So, if you hadn't started looking, I'm thinking some of these things would have been discarded.
I would probably say most of it was discarded. When I started looking for items and asking friends of the family, most of it was being pulled out of garages. And they would arrive in boxes still marked, the newspaper was still 1945 and they were wrapped in things. For the most part, they weren't displayed in homes. They were simply stashed away somewhere and forgotten.
Was there a magazine that you went through? How did you spread the word that you were looking for these things?
I asked my uncle if he could ask around, and a lot of these items actually came from a little town of Lodi in the Central Valley of California. Most of them were sort of embarrassed. It was like, I don't know if this is good enough for a book, but if you're interested, if you want to borrow it, be my guest. And they were arriving with amazing objects.
Well, some of them are so beautiful. We're going to, by the way, have pictures of all the objects on our website, here-now.org, and we want to hear even more about them. But the title of your book, Gaman, a Japanese word. What does it mean, and why, did you choose it?
Gaman essentially means enduring the seemingly unbearable with patience and dignity. And this was a term that was used frequently during camp and after camp. I heard my parents and grandparents say it often. Every time you sort of complained that something was hard or people were picking on you, they would say, you just have to come on. And basically, I think that's what the people in the camps did. They put up with a very difficult situation with patience and dignity.
Right, and you write that the difficult situation for many of the elderly people who returned from the camps is that they became these day laborers when, in fact, prior to the war, they might have been, educated, had fine jobs.
People lost a lot. I mean, because the evacuation took place within a 3-month span, and essentially people were given 1 week to get rid of all of their belongings.
And they only saved a few things because in this week that they were told to get ready to evacuate, they could only bring, one suitcase. You found one of the bird pins, and the carved birds, copied from an old National Geographic issue using snips of the screening from their barracks for the legs.
Yeah, that was sort of funny because at first they were trying to figure out how to attach the bird to some kind of limb or something. And somebody noticed that because the camps were made so hastily that the workmen had just slapped mesh over the doors and the windows, and there was all this mesh wiring around there, and they snipped it off and they made the perfect gauge for the legs and to tie around the branches.
Hmm. I'm looking at a picture of a vest. How do I say that?
It's called Senin Bari.
Senin Bari.
Which means essentially 1,000 stitches.
It's exquisite. It's let's see. It's a white sort of silk, and in the center is a big orange tiger. And yeah, there are these stitches across it, little red tufts. Why 1,000 stitches, and what does that mean?
In 1943, the army or the War Department decided that they could draft people from the camps or enlist them, and so a Japanese tradition when you send somebody in harm's way was to create either a vest or a sash or something. And each of these stitches, the 1,000 stitches which stood for long life, had to be put on by a different person.
This vest that you have pictured was made for George Matsushita, who served with the All-Japanese American 442nd in Italy, and his mother made it.
If you look at it closely, there's actually blood on the vest. If you consider there are about 18,000 people, 19,000 people from the camps who were served in the armed services. There are a lot of these around. Mm. My father's was actually done on an old rice sack, and my father served in Italy.
Then there's these carvings, these animal carvings on page 30.
I actually went to school with this artist's son, and Mr. Owe was a farmer in Lodi, California, and he not only carved these animals out of scrap wood, but he made the tools to carve them. He collected scrap metal from, you know, they sharpened butter knives, they melted down springs and things, automotive springs and things that they found, and they would melt them down in the boiler furnace and then hammer out their own tools. And he carved a number of really exquisite animals. And then when he left the camp, his son said he never carved again. Huh. It was something that was part of that period, and certainly the years after the war were so hard that the former evacuees had no time to turn to that. But I also think that it was a painful reminder of where they had been, so they didn't want to do it. But he was just filling his time, and as did most of the people who made many of these objects in camp.
Did they tell you or did you hear why they did it? Because as you point out, few of them were trained artists.
There was only one actual artist who I was able to speak with in person, and he told me, he said, we had nothing to do. When they were put in the camps, the only thing that was there was a metal cot and a mattress ticking that they were told to go fill with straw. And there was nothing else. So the first things they tried to do was just make bare essentials like clothes hangers and chairs and tables. And from there, you know, the arts program grew. But at first it was really out of necessity.
It really is eye-opening to see these images. Are there any plans to exhibit them?
There are a couple of museums who are interested in doing a show. There, you know, and as this book is just getting out there in the bookstores, and I'm hearing from more and more people, Japanese Americans, who are saying, you know, I have something in my home. I've heard of more things after I finished the book than, you know, when I was working on it. And so I'm hoping that it would get larger exposure, because this is really, it really shows sort of the humanity of the people who were in the camps and what they did to survive. And, you know, I know I'm proud of them because I'm Japanese American, but I also think that they're quite exquisite in their own right.
Delphine Hiratsuna is the author of The Art of Gaman, Art and Crafts from the Japanese American Internment Camps, 1942 to 1946. And again, to see the exquisite images from the book, go to our website, here-now.org. Delphine Hiratsuna, thanks so very much.
Thank you very much.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.